a Simcar 13 road trip for us. So tell us about the recent journey. I've taken a few. You have one. What did you do? How did it go?
So this is strange because it's the second year in a row I've done this. And it's actually one of the benefits of residing in Europe is that you get to go on continental journeys. Of course, there are continental journeys in America as well, but European ones are more intense, I think. You get to you can hop from place to place in one day, and the places would be quite distant, not in geography, but in sort of
culturally,
in culture.
Sure.
So the last year we went on a road trip like this from, we took a ferry. We actually took our own car to Germany, drove around Germany to, first, Netherlands, then Belgium, and then back. And this year I rented a car, from Amsterdam and drove through a little bit through Holland and then out into Germany, south all the way down to Munich, actually all the way down to Austria, and Innsbruck, and then up to Berlin, which is in far east Germany.
It's quite a few kilometers, Horace.
Yeah, 2,700, I think.
That's good.
Altogether, yeah, in about a week.
Mm-hmm. I did that in Utah, by the way, one time, about that same distance. That's interesting. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, okay. It's mm-hmm. But it's like a triangle,
right.
from that point of view. Now, the objective. So it was just me and my son, part of the objective was to actually get out of the hair of my wife, who had a big project at work to complete, and it helped her a lot if we took that time alone.
The male presence was gone for a bit, yes.
Yeah, but it was. I had a gig in Berlin to speak in Berlin, which I coupled with the Amsterdam trip. So my son got to see Amsterdam, and then we drove from there to some friends in near Eindhoven, and then drove south to Munich. Now on the way, we sort of paid homage to some meccas. One is the Porsche Museum, which is Stuttgart, and
yes,
the BMW Museum, which is in Munich.
The cylinders.
I had been to the Mercedes Museum multiple times, but not to these other ones. And it's interesting how Germans really raise these altars to these brands, because it's hard to imagine just how beautiful and exotic looking these buildings are unless you're there. You know, they are monuments. They are just gorgeous. The BMW even has a separate facility called BMW World. And BMW World is this just beautiful building. It's architecturally stunning, in which you get to experience the BMW brand, and Mini as well now, and Rolls-Royce.
Rolls-Royce, right.
Yeah. So they have those things there. These cars you can look at, but also it's kind of like shops and mall-like atmosphere, and it's free, and you get to basically revel in it. And across the road, connected via a pedestrian bridge, you have the museum, which I think predates the World.
Right.
Same in the Porsche Museum, the building is just stunning to look at. It's adjacent to the factory, and so I could go on and on. I mean, Mercedes also built. They used to have a Pokey Museum. It was okay, but then they had to because there was this one-upmanship. All these other guys were building these spectacular temples. So they had to build one. So the Mercedes Museum is now a stunning thing as well. The collection is about the same as I remember it, but these are all. And I'm told that there's also a Volkswagen Museum, and I don't know if that's in Wolfsburg, but there might be. Also I don't know if Audi's mixed in with that. We drove by Wolfsburg, but we didn't stop because we were trying to make our way back to Amsterdam on time. So, next time maybe we'll hit Audi. And I don't know if there's an Opel museum, but I wouldn't be surprised, that they would go to every car maker.
Maybe Russell Sime, yeah, that could be. Yeah.
But so just to dwell a little bit on Porsche because the funny thing is Porsche is not a very modern, or I should say a very old. It is a very modern, but it's not a very old brand. It's post-war. It is, you know, late 40s till present. And so there isn't a lot of history to put in the museum. In fact, there's very few car types they built, right? They've got the 911. And if you want to see 911s, you can see a lot of 911s in their museum. In fact, it's a little bit hard to tell them apart. But they, you know, this is the old joke about Porsches that they're all the same, but,
just larger every few years. Though.
Yeah,
like the Mini.
They get bigger in some dimension. Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, it's like, I'm not a Porsche fanatic. I appreciate it, but I'm not someone who obsesses about it. But I tell you, if you do, it's the place to go. Because you'll just see. To me, the question was like, is this Porsche significant? What about this one? Because they were all Porsches, right? In the Mercedes Museum, you have a huge variety of transport, right? You have everything from buses and trucks to fire engines to, you know, Pope Mobile to you know, some the Imperial Japanese limousine and the racing vehicles, the record setters, the prototypes, and all. A huge, huge, I mean, they invented the car and they've been at it since 1886, right? So there's a lot of stuff there. Contrasting that with a Porsche, which is essentially a single car, there may have been one or two samples of the non-911s out there, but I'm sure most people didn't care that much about the 914.
So it wasn't full of Cayenne SUVs or Panamera?
No, they had a section with the modern cars, which is not interesting to me. I think there was nothing there exciting about the modern lineup. But for example, even the 914, 924, those models, you know, there's maybe one instance, or even the 928, there was one instance of those cars. So they were, however, dozens of instances of the 911 and all the racing variants of those. So certainly the racing stuff, if you're really into Porsche racing, endurance racing, those examples there are really, really worth looking at. But as far as being a comprehensive history of automobiles, it's a very narrow one. The BMW Museum is interesting also from that point of view, because BMW is sort of in between Porsche and Mercedes. They are a little bit older than Porsche, but a lot younger than Mercedes. They're older to the point where they were making cars. Well, they were making engines all the way back to,
sure,
to
aircraft
to the war.
Engines.
Yeah, aircraft engines and motorcycles were predating the war as well. So they have a large selection of motorcycles in a big wall that you can actually look at them from top to bottom across multiple floors that you can walk down on. And the motorcycle. So if you're a motorcycle person, that is the place to go. They have a couple of aircraft engines, including a jet engine that they were part of. The BMW made the engine for the Focke Wulf 190, which is the only rotary engine that was in use, as far as I know, by Germany in the war. So that's there in all its glory. Then they have the, you know, they also had racing. They also have the M series sort of sports cars or sports touring cars, and there's a bit of history, the 2002 and so on. So there was something a little bit more to sink your teeth in the BMW Museum. And of course, if you're a fan of the brand, you know, it's the place to go. So yeah, I enjoyed both of them. There, I still think the Mercedes Museum is really a proper museum for more of sort of the notion of the car and transportation, whereas the others are more brand-oriented.
Well, it's interesting in that you contrast, particularly BMW and Mercedes, because Mercedes, obviously, they own large trunk companies. They make buses. They make all sorts of different vehicles. And BMW, at least to this point, has been, in the current age, largely cars. And, you know, maybe that has helped Mercedes to survive some of their potholes along
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, they're more of a conglomerate, and that used to be called Daimler-Benz. Obviously, the Mercedes was the car only brand, and Daimler-Benz was the umbrella, you know, conglomerate. The BMW is a very much smaller company in comparison, and Porsche is smaller still. But now I think they're all dwarfed by Volkswagen. But you know, just as you know, you started on the story of road trips,
the journey, right?
And the thing is that this became quickly a trip also through these car. So Germany, in my mind, is very much about cars, and more so even than, you know, people think America has a car culture and the Americans are car obsessed. That's nothing compared to Germans.
No,
really.
I agree. Germany,
it's a different caliber altogether. Mm-hmm. I mean, the American concept is more around cars as a lifestyle, as something that empowers you and enables you to live the way you do. Because if you didn't have the car, you couldn't have suburbia. You couldn't have the entire atmosphere of these giant houses that people live in. Whereas in Germany, you could live without the car. Many people do. But the ones who have cars and are passionate about cars are passionate on a whole different level. They're on a technical level. They really, you know, understand specifications of cars. They're a lot more nerdy about them. They'll read magazines and newspapers filled with technical detail about metallurgy and the latest developments in camshafts. And this is the average person, not some sort of gearhead. They if you look at the toys, this is a great example. Go if you have a young child, a boy, and they enjoy these little toy cars, these little matchbox sized cars. I actually have this thing where I explain the world to people through the lens of toy cars, and I take as an example, I take a quintessentially American toy car, you know, this miniature cars, and the brand of the quintessentially American brand is Hot Wheels. The British brand, although it became more American lately, is Matchbox, and Matchbox and Corgi. Corgi is not easy to find anymore, but Matchbox, it was made in England. It said so on it for many decades.
Years. Yes, huge company. Yeah.
Huge company. So Matchbox was English. Hot Wheels was American. Mm-hmm. And the Germans have one. It's called Siku, S-I-K-U. And the Japanese have one, and it's called Tomica. And the French have one, and it's called Majorette. Now, if you were to take a representative sample of these cars from these manufacturers, preferably a few years ago when they were more distinctive and less homogenized, you would learn a lot about these cars or these cultures and the way they see the world from the way they made these cars. And they're only one manufacturer per country, right? And if you study, let's take the German. This is how deep it goes. If you take the German Siku, which is, the quintessential German toy die-cast car, you look on the bottom of it. It says, gives all the specs of the vehicle, top speed, horsepower, the engine capacity, and it, given in metric units, so like, you know, in PS, not horsepower, in kilowatts or whatever, then it gives the data in kilometers per hour maximum speed. So you have on the bottom of each vehicle, you have its specifications, and it's very, very specific. So they wouldn't create a fictional vehicle, although they may have a few now, but normally they would actually create a very accurate replica of the actual car, and it would be the actual model number. So it wouldn't be just the Mercedes C-Class. It would be a C63 or a C200
and AMG have, or whatever, you know, it might be. Yeah,
and it would give you the exact specs for that variant, right? Because it would be very, very precise. And that's the level of detail and attention to detail and sort of no nonsense, actual facts, please, is the way the Germans. Now, take for example Hot Wheels. Hot Wheels is mostly fictional vehicles. In other words, what I call fantasy cars, so that child can have fun sort of imagining And the designers of these things obviously are having fun imagining these things as well. So they're all wildly impractical imaginary vehicles. There are a few which are real, but there's no detail about where, you know, who makes them and what detail.
Yeah, sort of Wizard of Oz vehicles or.
Yeah. So thing, I think right? that they tapped into the American, the popular American yes. notion of what a car is, which is sort of like this very flashy sort of cartoonish like vehicle. And then you have the English, which are actually quite accurate, but not specific about the specs. They're usually, interestingly, the Matchbox, what I appreciate about them is they have some of the widest range of real vehicles. So their lineup tends to be very broad, and you'll see cars which are, you know, sort of older cars and their catalog, if you will, is very broad with actual cars. So there's that quality to them that they sort of appreciate a more broad spectrum. The French have interesting, I don't know if it's a particular French trait, but the French majorettes have suspension. They have working suspension. And, you know, when you lift the car and drop sense. it bounces. And
it's got Citroën, this,
yeah, they have this softness to them. And they also typically the doors open and close. Yeah. So they have a wonderful mechanical quality to them, but they're also more fragile as a result, and they also are not as accurate because in order to accommodate the suspension, they usually have to make a double floor, and so the car looks a bit odd from some angles. Lastly, the Japanese. Now, the Japanese are an interesting bunch because that's the home of these cartoons and these manga, these exaggerated features that they place on people in the characters in the anime world. And you see that coming through to their cars. They even put sort of what I call makeup on their cars. They exaggerate the windows. They color it with black, the trim, so that certain parts of the car look a little bit more eye-popping. And they're also, not in the sort of garish way that the Americans do, but in a more of a cartoonish way. And also, they have a very great, what I call, playability about them. They're not accurate to the degree the Japanese are, but they are representative. And yet, they take that sort of a little bit of a step towards the abstract. You know, it's like looking at an impression of a car. It's not a real car. It's an impression of that car. And so they have, you know, their catalog is filled with real cars. So you'll see, you know, let's say a Prius or something like that. But when you look at it real close, it's pretty obvious that it's not a very good scale model, if you will. It is sort of, it's a soft impression of a Prius that actually is designed that way. It's not because it's sloppy. It's not because they did a bad job copying it, but they actually softened it to the degree that actually the child feels like it's more approachable, more playable. And my son, I tell you, he just loves these Japanese ones. And you can't really get them unless you buy them in Asia. And he asks me every time he can, when am I going to go to Asia so I can buy some of these cars for him, because he can't get enough of them. So if anyone listening in Japan, send me some email.
Arrange a deal, yeah.
We'll do a deal. I bought some, actually. I did buy some through eBay from Hong Kong, and they shipped right. over a whole lot, but they turned out, it turns out to be an expensive way to get these toys. In any case,
they're good traders. Yeah. So the real question I have for you though on this journey is, have you now traded your one front drive car for rear drive after driving around in a diesel BMW?
Oh, right. So the car I'd rented, I forgot to mention, is
yes,
the BMW.
Dive into that horse. Yes.
316D.
Right.
And so, I've always liked the rear drive. I've had the Mazda MX-5 or the Miata. I've had the 190E rear drive. I've had the E-Class, several of those with rear drive. And actually, now I have the E500, which is actually all-wheel drive. And we have the Minis, which are front-wheel drive. Now, Minis are a BMW brand, but they're not really BMWs in that sense. So this was a BMW 3 Series rear drive, brand new. Only 6,000 kilometers on it, but a diesel and not a very big diesel either. Mm-hmm. And yet, I thought it was a great car. It was great for many reasons. One, it had a sufficient power. It was a manual, but it had sufficient power for what I needed. Okay, so it wasn't fully loaded with seven adults or anything like that, but it went around the cities very comfortably. It had automatic engine off at a stop.
And was that responsive? I've been in
cars. It was good enough.
Okay.
Yeah. If you press on the clutch, it starts. So the lights in Europe, by the way, don't go. The U.S. it's red, yellow, green, red. In Europe, they go red, yellow, green, yellow, red.
Right, yellow again. Yeah.
So, so you get a yellow before it goes green. Mm-hmm. And so you can start by pushing. You get that extra second to push the clutch in and then select the first gear. So it starts in that second and you're off. The other thing is that it had amazingly good mileage. We were going on the Autobahn, obviously. Sometimes I think the top speed I reached was 210, slightly over maybe. I don't know if the speedometer was quite accurate, but it was about 210 kilometers an hour. I'm not sure how much that is, but
it's a good pace. Yes,
I think it's over 130
right.
miles an hour, and it just could do that speed with a 1.6 diesel and returned about 5 liters per 100 kilometers in terms of mileage over the whole trip.
That's great.
We were, of course, at that speed, you're going a much higher burn rate, but still, you know, not all of it is at that speed. You know, you have traffic, you have all kinds of issues, a huge amount of construction. We witnessed even this is hilarious. I'm sorry to digress, but this is just, you know, those TV chases where, you know, usually you have a helicopter. I was in one of those. I mean, this is the amazing thing. I'm driving on a highway in Germany, and there's a pretty nice winding road. It's not in the Alps, but it's in an area where there are some hills. So there are parts where it's sweeping turns and you know, it isn't flat. And as we're going along, a black Audi overtakes on the breakdown lane. And of course, you're not usually looking in that direction.
Right.
So I didn't see him coming. I think I was not even in the right lane at the time. I was probably also passing at the time. So it was two lanes away from me, but it went by us, and we must have been doing 130 kilometers an hour at least. I think that was the limit at that point. It was not on that section that was unlimited speed, because those are usually flat and straight. This was on a bit of a twisty road. And yet he drove by us as if we were standing still. And I remember one thing about that car. It was a black Audi with no number plate. And I thought, and Henry, my son, was behind, in the back seat, and he also saw it. And he said, "What is that?" And we were like scratching our heads because we couldn't understand what kind of vehicle in Germany, because you think Germans are law-abiding people, and the only thought I had at the time was there must have been a police car or some kind of undercover police car, because they have those there as well, right? I didn't think it was a politician, because they also tend to obey the rules, and they have escorts and so on.
Not so much in the States, yeah.
Yeah, but it was, usually if it was some kind of diplomatic vehicle, you would have had flags on it, you would have had an escort of motorbikes or what have you. But no, it was just this one car. And it goes by, and I was pretty sure it was a police car. And then a real police car comes behind us and flashing lights and everything, and it overtakes us and goes on. And I said, "Aha! Well, that car must be chasing the other one," but he wasn't going as fast as that one, because he was being a little bit more responsible, I suppose, and he was having to weave through traffic, so he wasn't going on the breakdown lane. So this police car goes by, and I said, "Oh, okay. Well, maybe that black car was a bad guy, that was being chased." And then, after all that, a helicopter shows up and is following very close to the road, because the road is winding. And the helicopter is a German police helicopter, clearly marked, was following the contours of the road, probably looking for a place where that car might have gone off-road or escaped to some degree. So he was sweeping the road, all the way in front of us. And the interesting thing is that, okay, we see one thing, we see two things, we see three things, which are interesting, and we just say, okay, well, we'll never see any more. But at some point, the road narrowed. There were cones, or the equivalent of German cones, which are these rather large sticks that were visible. One was knocked down in this area where there were essentially a counter flow. So the road narrows so that the cars on the other side can come on your side and they can do repairs. And one of these sticks had been knocked over, and the police car was there inspecting that damage. And then the police car left and went in front of us. So we said, again, probably unrelated. Somebody hit a cone and nothing more to see there. Move along. But as we got to the end of this closed off area, we saw the original Audi pulled over to the side of the road with its front end smashed, and at least one wheel, well, the front right wheel was like gone. So and then the police were around that vehicle, right? And we just drove by, because actually, by the way, the nice thing about this experience was there was no traffic stoppage at any point. You know, there was no rubbernecking, so to speak. So these things flashed by us very quickly, and we didn't really register them very deeply, but because there was no traffic to slow you down and you wouldn't stare. So what I make it out as is that the black Audi was probably either a stolen car or most probably stolen, even from a dealer, because it didn't have number plates. Someone was out for a joyride, and they were just going as fast as they could go in this thing. When the road narrowed, that driver probably hit that cone, causing sufficient damage, tire damage, so that the vehicle essentially disintegrated one of the wheels. And it finally was immobilized at the end of that section, and finally they caught up with him at that point. So that is my story. That was very, very strange to experience such a series of events in Germany, you know, of all places. And so, but of course, my son, he loved it because he thought this was the greatest thing ever. He could Action. Reenact this whole thing sure. with a helicopter, and and you know, he's probably dreaming about this for days. Yeah, of course, there's a lot of danger. That person could have hurt themselves and others. But anyway, these things do happen even in Europe, right? You've got people who either are probably too young to know better, and then they get on these joyrides.
So what did you pay for the car for a week horse?
It was pretty reasonable. I think all in, it was about 300 euros on Sixt, XT. And I've used them before. They tend to give you these better cars.
Better cars,
I picked that class of car. I could have ended up with something else, maybe even a C-Class, but they ended up actually delivering the BMW. As I said, it was great feeling to drive on any road. It had sufficient power and sufficient, and the fuel economy was really great. Given even the fact that diesel tends to be cheaper in Europe, then you end up with probably a fuel bill roughly equivalent to what a U.S. driver might have to pay if they drove an SUV. So in that sense, it was reasonably economical car. And also the other great thing about it, speaking of technology, though, is that it had a sat-nav system built in. And none of my cars ever had this. And I finally got to use one at length, not just on a rental car, like for a day or so. So usually in a day, you don't get to learn it very well. So I got to use this BMW system for navigation.
iDrive thing, yeah.
In the iDrive. Right. Once you get used to the selection process, which is very painful, by the way, to find.
Oh, I know. I mentioned that when I drove the i3. The interface is really terrible. Yes, I agree.
If you only have 5 minutes, you're just going to give up. But if you have, like we did, 5 days, you get to know it. And the great thing about it is that I had a smartphone. I had more than one, but we would have had to pay roaming to be able to use the maps. So in that sense, it saved me money on the roaming. Secondly, it works without having to worry about having a stand for your phone. It works without having to worry about having power for your phone. So there are these intangibles. The resolution is poor, and some things on the smartphone are way better, especially entering stuff into it. It even got us lost on the last day because the destination we were going to, a hotel, was on a newly built site, newly developed site, and the roads didn't exist in its database for that particular location. Right. So we had to
I've had those experiences, yeah.
Much better, I'm sure that would have been found. In fact, you go to your phone for backup in those situations,
right,
and it works better. So that was a positive, though. You just keep it on all the time, and it would tell you things like how you punch in the BMW museum or whatever your destination,
sure.
And it just for the whole day you're watching how much further you got to go, It gives you the ETA, and you're saying, okay, great, we can stop now, have lunch, and so on. So a few more anecdotes, by the way, if I may. Germans, there's a receipt for everything, right? So you know, I ended up with a wallet full of receipts because I'm going buying stuff all the time. But you also have to pay for going to the bathroom. And you get a receipt for it. So I have a documentary evidence of all my trips to the toilet. And the reason for this is, you ask the questions, why? Well, their rest areas they decided that they didn't like the idea of people abusing the toilets and making them filthy. So they decided to have cleaners for them. But in so doing, you have to sort of pay for use. And so for paying for use, you have to have a machine that, you know, not a person, but a machine that takes your coins.
Put a euro in, right?
And the reason why they don't just take the coins and let you go, but give you a receipt, is because you can use that receipt back at the restaurant to get a discount on that toilet trip. And so, but I never did. I didn't quite feel up to it that I, you know, go to the toilet,
complete the circle,
pay 70 cents, which was the price, take the receipt back to the restaurant, you know, your Burger King or what have you, and say, would you give me 20 cents back because I'm entitled to that. So I never quite bothered to do that. But and I suppose you should do it in the opposite sequence. Go to the bathroom first and then go go eat. But I that doesn't work right for me. So there was this whole question, and I'm stuffing my receipts in my phone, I mean in my wallet, and children get to go free because they have a little cutout of a child that they pass through in this gate. So there's this lower gate that you walk through. Now, that's one anecdote. The other anecdote is water. If you go to a McDonald's, my son doesn't like carbonated drinks. He only drinks milk or water, which is a great thing, I think.
Good job. Yeah, way to
but
go, Horace.
But I didn't have anything
maybe
to do
it's
with
your
it.
Wife.
That was, no, he was all him. He just doesn't like them. So we go to a McDonald's, and we order something for him, and I said, you know, we sat down. I actually asked for milk, and they said they didn't have any. So, all right. So we just sat down, and I thought, hang on, I got to go back and get a water for him. And I said, I asked for water, and they said, I'm going to have to give you from the fountain. He pointed to the fountain, you know, the soda fountain. And I said, sure, from whatever. I don't care where you get it from. So he went in and filled it up, and I had to pay for it. And it was 1.70 euro. And I looked at it and I said, are you kidding? And for just tap water? Well, I didn't call it tap water. I just said, it's just for water. And he said, yes, the same price as a Coke. Okay, fine. So I paid for the water, bring it back to him. And he takes a sip and he says, I can't drink this. It's carbonated. So what happened is that he gave me the carbonated water without the syrup in it. So it was basically a Coke without syrup. And so I went back and I said, don't you have any tap water? And they said, no tap water, no milk. Only option you had was to get the syrup or non-syrup carbonated drink. And so we had to go to another place nearby, a sort of a cafe, to finally buy a bottle of real water
the future.
And they discuss, you know, when you go to a restaurant, you have this negotiation with the waiter about water, because they give it to you automatically carbonated, right?
Not always.
So you have to say, you know, with or without gas.
Gas. Yes,
that's understood. I knew that routine from the restaurant routine, but I didn't know that about the Burger King,
the fast food
McDonald's.
Places. Right, yeah.
And the last thing about that is you have to pay for your ketchup.
No,
which is
funny.
Which I think is true at McDonald's, but not necessarily at Burger King. So anyway, just warnings out there for people who are from America
taking road trips. Yeah, well, I'm glad you talked about the brand meccas, because I remember being in London a while ago, and Audi has a huge showroom. And, you know, that back in the day, the French automakers had their big showrooms in Paris and the Champs-Élysées. And it's interesting how it's evolved. But I was looking into a bit of dealer data or franchise or sales data over the past month, and I came across a Alfred Sloan quote. He said, and of course he was the chairman of General Motors. He's the guy that really built General Motors into a conglomerate. He said between 1923 and 1929, the leveling of demand for new cars logically resulted in a change of emphasis in the industry from production to distribution. On the sales end, that meant a change from easy selling to hard selling. Dealer problems of an entirely new nature began to arise. And I found this in a paper that a couple professors wrote in 2009 about car dealers, history, regulation, and some data. And it was interesting because they talked about all the states and the regulation. This is U.S. I found smattering of data for different countries around the world, but there's quite a bit for the U.S. And there were a couple pieces of data that struck me. One was sales per dealer in the U.S. Toyota ranges over the past 15 years from 1,500 new cars per year to about 2,400, 2,500 per dealer. Nissan is about 1,000. Honda, 1,000 to 1,400. And then you have the traditional U.S. companies, Ford, GM, and Chrysler, from 400 to 700, roughly, 600.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And, much smaller
and whole different costs. And so then I dove in further, and I found the U.S. North American Dealer Association, or National Dealer Association, and it's interesting how they spin their business. So they have data, and they show you the number of dealers as a percentage of total retail establishments in the state. So Massachusetts, for example, it's about 1.8% of all retail institutions are car dealers. Mm-hmm. My state of Wisconsin, 2.8, average is about 2. But then they go and they say dealer sales as a percentage of total retail sales. So this is the sales tax thing. Massachusetts, it's 14.4. Maryland, 15.9. Oklahoma, 17. Texas, 17. California, 16. Wisconsin, 13.5. So that gives you an indication of why they have political power. And the same thing, they had data on payroll, you know, number of employees as a percentage of total retail employment, and on and on and on. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is the number of dealers has declined quite a bit in the U.S. From a high of 50,000 post-World War II to about 17,000. There was a culling in the Great Recession, but it's grown a little bit recently. Uh-huh. And so you have this emphasis on distribution, obviously, and something that Tesla is trying to change. Yeah,
you can't understand the auto business unless you understand two things. It's not about the cars. It's about production, number one, and distribution, number two. These are the two fundamental linchpins, if you will, of that industry. You can't understand it unless you understand those two things. So that's the production side is actually probably easier to understand of those two, because you've got essentially books and books written about production technique. It's a matter of folklore. It's a matter of historical significance that auto industry. Everybody knows Henry Ford and what he did, and the miracle of the post-war U.S. economy was driven a lot by that. But very few people understand the economics of dealerships and distribution. And when you start to look at it, let's say from an outside point of view, this is a couple of shocking things should immediately leap out. Number one is these statistics you cite, but in particular, just how many dealers there are. The fact that they seem to be sometimes more common than
grocery stores, right, that
people, consumables that are necessities and staples. Secondly, is that they're typically owned by individuals. There's the quintessential small business. They're not something that became a chain.
Right.
Almost everything else in retail is a chain. Very few mom and pop stores remain. And that's kind of something that people lament, I suppose. Many do, right? You've got the disappearance of that particular sector of the economy, the small retail. But in case of dealerships, that's still the case. And there might be some consolidation going on a regional level. And certainly there are these individuals who own maybe a multiple number of dealerships. But the question should be, why isn't there a dozen or so nationwide dealership chains? There isn't such a thing as far as I know, right? You don't have...
There are a few that have tried. There's a public one, Auto Nation, I think, and Auto Max. But when you dive into this paper, which we'll post a link to in the show notes, you know, you see phrases like, even if it's healthy, they're talking about consolidation, even if it's healthy for the auto industry long term, closing thousands of dealerships will create a huge amount of collateral damage to Main Street institutions like Little League Baseball and local newspapers. This is 2009.
Well, there are always victims. I mean, right. But if you look at the radio stations, is another example. Radio stations went through a consolidation. Newspapers went through consolidations. These are, again, as I said, lamented. I'm not judging good or bad. It's just it happens because there's probably a force acting upon the industry. The force is some economic force is acting. So consolidation is part and parcel of the process of birth and death that happens in industry. In fact, it's a healthy process usually. It's a painful one, but it's probably something that needs to happen in order for innovation to take place.
Right.
So this is the fundamental question, right? And consolidation happens usually at a stage when you can't get any more improvement from the current structure. So you have the improvement comes from efficiency, quote unquote, and that's cutting of costs, and that means consolidation. So you're better off having three dealerships rather than one, and that's why, you know, operationally it makes sense, and so on and so on. So I won't belabor that, but the point is that when you study that industry and you ask yourself, what's going on here? Why are dealerships so, first of all, distributed the way they are? What are their economics? What are their conditions under which there isn't any shift to the business model, any change in the fundamental way of that business? Now, one thing that we hear is that there's less and less emphasis on the sale of cars and more on the servicing of cars, and that has its own dimension there as far as that causing dealerships to persist. But still, I think there are some open questions. At least there are for me. Why the industry is the way it is, and I think it's under analyzed, underreported.
I completely agree. So I read this paper and I kept digging a bit, and it turns out that these two professors trace the genesis of regulation to the 1920s. And I remember when Henry Ford, or the history of Henry Ford, producing the Model T beyond the point at which it was competitive or compelling, and they talked about how he took advantage of his dealer network by channel stuffing, essentially forcing them to buy inventories of cars that they were unlikely to sell. And then General Motors did the same thing. And this led to dealers pushing back and saying, you know, you're killing us, and therefore that all begat the regulation that we see today.
Right. That makes sense. You know, you can have an adversarial relationship with your distribution chain. You can have channel conflict of all kinds, right? And I think governments stepped in over the years, over the decades, to break up value chains so that you have a network instead of a vertically integrated value proposition. And then that may have some benefits to competition, but at some point you'll see that value chains need to evolve. And that's the I think this is a Christensen foundational theory, that value chain evolution is a function of the change in the technological core of the industry. So when the core technology changes, what used to be called disruptive innovation or disruptive technology, what happens is that the value chains need to reorganize themselves because profits are going to be distributed differently. And so in order for that, if you if you regulate or legislate that cannot happen, then you essentially put a break in the possible innovations that can happen. So that's a very, very, you have to be a domain expert to kind of call that whether it is or isn't happening. But my guess would be that indeed this dealership, the way the dealerships are structured are, and these puzzles, these paradoxes of the industry are saying that, why is it that X doesn't happen that seems to happen everywhere else? It might be rooted in exactly this question of regulation and legislation, which ultimately might be the Achilles heel to the whole industry, because you realize then that, as Tesla is showing, that you cannot, in order for you to really make the leap in technology needed to bring a new drivetrain, a new ecosystem to bear, you've got to also reintegrate the value chain.
Right,
and that's in fact, that's what Apple did. If you look at Apple and Apple retail,
well, that was the parallel. Exactly. This is exactly the same thing.
Apple, why did Apple launch retail? And by the way, I just posted, today happens to be the day. If you're listening to this later, this is the 13th anniversary of the Apple stores happened yesterday. Today's being the May 20th. And so the first Apple store opened on May 19th, 2001. And the interesting thing, so it's been 13 years, and it's been a phenomenal success. The most profitable stores per square foot in terms of sales per square foot that I think the world has ever seen, and also the steady growth in every metric imaginable, from sales to number of stores to employees to visitors, and these. Patterns of growth, I mean, obviously are driven by the change in the product that Apple shipped over these years. But fundamentally, the formula has been a very, very solid one. And Apple, I think, this is Steve Jobs, realized that what was broken about selling computers, especially the Macintosh in the 1990s, was that customers couldn't get the chance to play with them, and they needed to actually have someone explain it to them. And that was done by resellers, but they increasingly had disincentives to do so for the Mac. And so he decided, you know, not because of some grand vision about value chain evolution, but rather that it was a necessary thing to do to keep the franchise alive. So build stores where people can discover the product.
Right. He routed around the existing distribution network.
Right. And you can see the evolution that happened and the redesign of the stores that happened over time. And now perhaps we'll see yet another redesign as they move into wearables.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a lot of sense that if you go from computers to devices, that you redesign the stores around the device as the new object. So you don't have rows. I remember the very first Apple stores, right? They were more traditional in shape. They had cash registers in the front. They had rows of software and hardware in the back. You walk through a maze of shelves. Now it's all clean, open space with these giant tables, and anything that's big is on the edges of the store, and everything that's small is in the middle of the store, where it doesn't break the sight lines.
Right.
And then you have the bar at the back, and the kids section, and the theater, and all that stuff in the middle. So you had this design. It was not there on day one, but it was necessary to have a store because the product needed to be discovered. And eventually, it became a service place as well with the Genius Bar. And then, you know, now there's 100 Apple employees per store on average. And some obviously are huge, like flagship stores that have hundreds of employees, and some are smaller. But on average, if you take number of stores and number of employees, it actually comes out to be about 100 per. So that's an interesting fact, is that they work in shifts, so not all 100 are in the store at once, but there's a huge amount of people. If you
local
think how
employment,
many,
sure.
If you took that footprint of a store next door to it, let's say it was an Abercrombie Fitch or something like that, there's probably 3 employees in that store, right? At most, yeah. So that's the difference. An Apple store is a hive of activity with all these blue shirts or whatever the color of the day is. But the point though is this, that Apple built stores because it needed to build stores, and it's an OEM. It's the brand.
Sure, it went direct. Mm-hmm.
It went direct. And It still has parallel networks, which are in conflict, obviously. This is why the resellers are have generally, they tend to disappear whenever Apple's store opens in their neighborhood. But so we still have them, for example, in parts of Europe here or Asia or anywhere else where there are no Apple stores. Apple stores are absent from most countries, right? So they do need those partners, but I'm afraid they're disposable partners when Apple
when the time is right, definitely.
So what the government essentially did is that it said, for as far as cars are concerned, at U.S. in particular, that you cannot have this owner, the owner of the dealership cannot be the same as the owner of the OEM. And by the way, also that happened in the film industry in the 1940s.
Oh, right.
The film studios owned distribution and retail. Essentially, they owned production, distribution, and retail. They're vertically integrated. They had studios. They had they obviously distributed to their own retail, which was the theaters they would own. And then the government said, no, we're going to break that over here and here. And so what ended up is that they lost production, typically. They lost retail, and they remained only with distribution. That's what Hollywood is today. So point being, I don't have the answer sort of like whether this can actually be solved or not, because I don't quite understand. Even another way to analyze this is you have to look at all the countries in the world and ask, does, if you didn't have regulation, let's say the Philippines, I don't know what the rules are there. Let's assume a country X doesn't have any rules about dealerships, and yet they're probably there anyway. Is that because
implicit rules? I did look at that for different countries, and what I found was, and again, I didn't compile deep data, but what I found is that there are often, I guess, I don't know the term, but there's sort of a master distributor, and then they sublicense.
In some countries, that's probably, there's even a monopoly,
right, exactly.
You know, given to a local player.
A certain
player
trading group or political group or who knows, right?
Because they know how to sell, right? So you give that concession because they know how to get it done. So, you know, there are
these cellular operators, Horace.
Yeah.
So, but the interesting bit of data that I wanted to share, too, when I dove into this a bit was, so they're the largest U.S. car group is something called AutoNation, New Car Dealer. And last year they sold just under 300,000 new cars, and that's about 2% roughly of the U.S. market. So that tells you how fragmented it is, and it goes down fast. Number two is Penske. There are about 200,000 cars. And when you get to number 20, it's 35,000 cars. So, I mean, it just drops precipitous. So it's very fragmented. And I think that might explain a little bit of the importance of the production system, because having a widely dispersed retail channel has its challenges, but it also allows the manufacturers to, you know, prop some up and keep competition going and stuff the channel and all the things they do, I suppose.
Yeah, who knows? Someone sent me a link to, speaking of channel stuffing, someone sent me a link to an inflammatory and I would say arguably probably completely false post. I'm not going to relink it. It's not worth it. But it was one of these things that said that the world was awash in unsold cars.
I saw that.
Yeah, and the thing is that they showed all these photographs. Some were satellite photographs. Right. Some were aerial photographs with these huge areas filled with inventory.
Inventory.
Now,
right.
Obviously, there are places where the inventory sits, but I think the you can get that data on how many weeks, months of inventory are sitting in any, you know, that data is not something you need to put in 100 photographs. It is a standard measure of performance of the industry. If you have too many days of inventory, you know things
factory
are really
problems.
Bad, and you can track that month to month, and everybody would know it. But I think that there are issues with the fact that you have a dealership network that may actually increase the inefficiency, if you will. So Tesla can build a car and deliver it on a as needed basis. So there isn't that need to stock inventories. The notion of a Tesla, there is no Tesla dealer. What it is a showroom. It's a place you get to see the car, maybe test drive the car, and then you place your order, and then they deliver the car to you. You don't go on the lot and drive a car out at the end of the day, probably a different one than you actually wanted. So that's another question you have to ask. Does the dealer network actually create huge losses because of waste in inventory? And maybe the auto industry is actually more prone to catastrophe because of what did happen in 2008 is indeed that they couldn't react efficiently to the crunch
to the world, right?
Yeah, so they're dependent on credit to a great deal. They're dependent yes. on
well, the whole on, system. You look at the inventory they keep. I mean, it's 30 to 90 to 100 days. There's a lot of cash tied up,
and it's so that. As a yeah. result, it was so fragile, and that's what caused bankruptcy for GM. It caused problems for everyone, but in particular, I think the only reason the industry even exists the way it is because of political support. It would have, yes. I think, the 2008 would have caused normally a mass extinction event. Right? We would have seen normally if things were
a new structure. There's no doubt. Well, one of the rumors was that Penske, who's the number two race car guy, number two U.S. car dealer group, would have picked up some pieces of General Motors. So, yeah, it would have been very, very different. But
it would have been
here
very.
We are. So we've had a good talk today from another journey and then regulation and distribution channels. And we'll look forward to continuing it in a SIMCAR 14, Horace.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Yeah.